Welcome to We the Podcast. This is Keith Ellison's periodic podcast. Keith is back in Minnesota, so I'm going to fill in for him. My name is Dan Riffle. I handle communications here in the office for Keith. And I'm here with Matt Bruning. Matt is an intellect on the left, and he is the head of the People's Policy Project. Did I get that right?
That's right.
It's a people-funded think tank on the left, not funded by corporate contributions, not funded by major donors, but just funded by small-dollar donors who are trying to get some think tank policy ideas out there for people, working class people, poor people, to represent the rest of us. And one of the ideas that Matt had was the social wealth fund. So we're going to talk about that. But before we get into what a social wealth fund is, Matt, why do we need it? What is the problem that your social wealth fund is intended to address?
Right. So it addresses two problems, basically. The first is wealth inequality. So the U.S. has about $100 trillion of wealth, if you add up all the wealth of all the households. But 80% of that is owned by people who have $1 million of assets or more, right? Millionaires. The bottom third of America, on net, owns nothing. So you have a millionaire class that owns 80% of all the wealth, and an underclass that owns none of the wealth. And then you have a small middle class that owns a little bit of it. And so that's sort of problem one. And problem two is that income inequality is really high. I mean, we've been talking about this now for, it seems like, 10 years, right? And the 1%, their share of the income just keeps going up and up and up. And while wages and other kinds of incomes for middle and lower income people continue to stagnate. Well, one of the reasons why income inequality is so high is because wealth inequality is so high. If you own a lot of assets, that gets you income. That's how it works. And so if we're really trying to tackle income inequality in a big way, we're going to have to cut down on wealth inequality, which means finding ways to spread out wealth ownership and help equalize wealth ownership. And that's what the Social Wealth Fund tries to do.
What does that income look like for the people who are really wealthy, who have all of these assets? I mean, most of us know income as the paycheck that we get from our job. But you're saying for people who are really wealthy, there's no paycheck that they get. They get their wealth or they get their income other ways. What does that look like?
Right. So for example, the top 1%, about 56% of their income comes from ownership of stock, bonds, and real estate. So they'll get, for instance, every quarter, if you own a stock, you'll get a dividend. And it'll be a small percentage of the value of the company that just gets kicked out to you. We've seen a lot of talk recently about buyouts or stock buybacks, I should say. Mm-hmm. What is a stock buyback? It's a way to shovel money out to shareholders. Well, who are shareholders? Overwhelmingly, the very wealthiest people in the country are shareholders. So that's how it works. You own land, you own debt, the other side of debt, not in debt, but own the debt, and you own shares of companies. And if you own enough of that stuff, you just kind of get free money, just sort of flows to you every few months in the form of dividends, interest, and rents. But if you don't own that stuff, which is the vast majority of Americans, the only thing you have is labor income, or maybe you might receive some social benefits, maybe you get Social Security or something like that. That's what you rely on. The top does not rely on that stuff.
Okay, so we're going to get into the social wealth fund thing, but you touched a little bit on stock buybacks, and Keith just put out a bill on stock buybacks last week. So tell me a little bit more about buybacks. What exactly are they? What do they look like? How do they work?
Right. So when you're a company and you have cash from earnings, right, you've got profit. There are a few things you can do with that. One thing you can do is you can pay out a dividend where you just say, okay, we have a million shareholders and we have $1 million of cash. Let's just give them each a dollar. Okay, that's one way to do it. Another thing you can do is reinvest it. So you say, oh, well, we have $1 million. Why don't we expand operations, hire people, invest in building new facilities, that sort of thing. And the third thing you can do is you can buy back your own stock. And so you just take that $1 million and you say, hey, I'll buy back, such and such number of shares, whatever $1 million will buy me. And the net result of that is there are now less shares of my company floating out in the world, but my company is as valuable as it used to be. The value of those shares go up. The people who own those shares make money from the value of those shares going up. So it's kind of like a dividend, but it's a little bit different.
Got it. So the people who own the stocks are selling their stocks back to the company, essentially, you're saying?
Yeah, so some of them sell to the company. That's how the company buys it back. But the ones who continue to hold on to it, who don't sell, their stock also just goes up in value. Sort of paper wealth goes up. And if they wanted to sell.
Because it's a bigger percentage of the outstanding stock of the company.
Right. Yeah.
Got it. Okay. You wrote a post on Medium called Nickel and Dime Socialism, which was about social wealth funds. What is it? What's the idea? Tell us about it.
So a social wealth fund is sort of like an endowment. So you know how universities will have these big funds where I think Harvard's is up to $40 billion. And those funds are invested in stocks and bonds and real estate. And then those investments generate a return. That return is then used by the school to fund things, to fund professorships, research, that sort of stuff. Social wealth fund is basically taking the idea of an endowment, but doing it for the country as a whole. Okay. So the way it would work is you'd create this fund, an investment fund run by the government. The government would give one share of ownership to every adult in the country. Then they would gradually fill up the fund, just like universities gradually fill up their endowments. And as that fund put off investment returns, everyone would receive those investment returns in equal amounts. So it's sort of a kind of indirect way of socializing ownership of wealth using instruments that already exist in our current economy and without being too disruptive.
So you said that the government would fill up the fund. How would that look like? How would they fill up the fund?
So there are a number of possibilities, right? So one is that you could use debt financing. So the Treasury issues bonds every year or every day, really, and those bonds have an interest rate. Those interest rates, I did a little check earlier, are run around 3% for a one-year bond. The rate of return of the S&P 500 runs around 8%. So if you issue a 3% Treasury bond, invest it in the S&P 500, get an 8% return, that spread in the middle becomes investment return, and you can use that to pay off dividends. Another approach is through taxes, right? So what we're trying to do with the social wealth fund is get wealth that is currently held by mainly very affluent people and move it into the social wealth fund. So what you want to do is you want to apply targeted taxes that really hit the wealthiest Americans. So things like financial transactions tax, things like taxes on the market capitalization of companies.
Estate taxes?
Estate taxes. Inheritance and estate taxes are one of the best, I think, sort of conceptual mechanisms for this, because what is inheritance, right? Someone dies and they leave you money. The idea of a social wealth fund would be, well, if someone dies, we'll all, you know, we'll get a collective inheritance. So, you know, and you wouldn't necessarily take all of it, but you could imagine a world where you say, look, half of what you have left over when you die goes into the social wealth fund and everyone benefits equally, and half will go to your descendants. And so through that kind of process, you can gradually build up the wealth fund and reduce wealth inequality, reduce income inequality.
Okay. So you made some comparisons to, like, for example, the Harvard endowment. Is there anything on a bigger scale? Are there other countries that have something like this?
Yeah, so we have one in our own country, in Alaska. Okay. It's called the Alaska Permanent Fund. It was created in the 1970s. And it's now up to about $60 billion, I think. It goes up every day. And what they did is they took proceeds from natural resource extraction and they just put it into this fund. And every year, you know, as they mine minerals and oil and that sort of thing, they take a big chunk of the income from that and they just keep putting it in this fund. And they never touch the principal of the fund. But every year, that fund generates investment return because it's invested, like we say, in an endowment like stocks, bonds, real estate. And they take that investment return and they pay it out as a permanent fund dividend. That's what they call it. And so on good years, it's been as high as $2,000 per person, which for a family of four would be about $8,000. So it's already a proven model in the US in one state. Globally, there are 60 of these funds throughout the world. They're not all used for this purpose. Some of them are not well run. But probably the global leader is Norway. Norway has two big social wealth funds, and then they also have a portfolio of state-owned enterprises. And if you add all that stuff up together, they end up owning around 60% of all the wealth in Norway.
60%?
60%. Wow. And if you take out homes, because 90% of like middle-aged Norwegians own their own home. If you take that out, they end up owning over 75% of the wealth in the country. And so what ends up happening is they end up generating massive amounts of income from just sort of passive wealth ownership that in the US goes to the richest people in the country, because the richest people are the people who really own this stuff. So I did some numbers for a paper that I'm about to release. And last year, if Norway had paid out a dividend in the same way Alaska does from all of its holdings, it would have been $25,000 per person.
Wow.
So you're talking 100 grand for a family of four. Now, last year was a really good year for the stock market. It's not always that high, but I mean, that's like the level that it has been taken to elsewhere in the world.
This sounds a lot like a universal basic income, almost. Is this kind of another way to do this?
Yeah, I mean, one term for the payments that would go to people from this fund is universal basic dividend. There's a movement in Europe called DiEM25 that has a proposal along these lines, and they call it a universal basic dividend. So, yeah, I mean, it ends up being just a straight, you know, cash check you get every year, like they do in Alaska already. But it's based on ownership of capital, as opposed to, you know, cutting welfare or, you know, raising taxes or something like that. And I think it's important to emphasize, you know, when people talk about basic income, which this is sort of a flavor of, they often act like, you know, they'll often say, can you really get money for nothing, money without working? And one of the things I really like about this approach to basic income is it highlights that people already get money for nothing. Like if you own these assets, you already get dividends and interest and rents. That's already a thing that happens. 30% of the income in the country is paid out passively to people who just own assets every year. So the basic idea here is, can we grab that 30% and spread it out to everyone, as opposed to being held by a small percentage of people at the top of society?
Got it. So this universal basic dividend, not income, would go out. Do you see that as like a replacement for things like food stamps, TANF benefits, other forms of welfare?
No. I mean, I explicitly see it as a replacement for the payments, the way that the dividends are, who are already receiving those dividends, right?
Yeah.
Millionaires in the U.S. own 80% of all the wealth, according to the Survey of Consumer Finances, the last one they put out. So they're receiving about 80% of all of this sort of passive income, dividends, interest, rents. The idea is, we're already paying this out to people who don't work for it. Why don't we pay it out to everyone in smaller amounts? It's not a replacement for existing welfare payments. It's a replacement for existing capital income payments to the most affluent people in society.
Got it. So you talked earlier about how, when you mentioned the Norway example, what exactly the payout would have been if they did distributions in Norway, which they don't like they do in Alaska. But then you said, you know, it was particularly high last year because last year was a good year for the stock market. So my question is, what happens in a bad year for the stock market? I mean, already we see people who, you know, get laid off, lose their jobs, you know, companies contract, housing bubbles burst. What if, in addition to all of that, this dividend that people eventually will start to rely on and, you know, budget into their household budgets, what if that shrinks? Does this exacerbate the downturns of a recession?
Well, so it's going to depend on how you design the dividend. So in Alaska, for instance, they have designed the dividend so that it pays out a moving average of the last 5 years of return. So it's not every year exactly what we made that year, because like you said, there is a lot of volatility. Some years you'll make 20% return, some years you'll make negative 10% return.
Yeah.
But if you take over a five-year period and you average it out, you really cut a lot of that volatility and the payments end up being fairly similar. They do change a little bit, but not to the same extent as the year-to-year change in the stock market. So that's how you would kind of fix that problem.
Yes.
It's just through averaging.
So speaking of economic downturns, one of the ways that you've written about in terms of funding this thing is counter-cyclical asset purchases,
right,
which sounds really highbrow to some of us, but dumb it down for me. What exactly does that mean?
Right, so when the Federal Reserve is trying to fight recessions, one of the things it does is it creates new money and then it goes out and it buys, in particular, treasury bonds. So since 2007, the Federal Reserve created about think it's $2 trillion worth of money, and they went out and they just bought treasury bonds. And that is a little helpful because that means that, you know, you kind of give the treasury a break because, you know, the bonds go to the Federal Reserve, and then the Federal Reserve pays any interest on the bonds right back to the treasury. So that's a little bit helpful. But if you want it to be really helpful, what you would do is instead of buying $2 trillion worth of treasury bonds, go out and buy $2 trillion worth of stock or corporate bonds or real estate. You can buy those same assets through the same mechanisms, and those assets are going to generate way more return. I mean, like, imagine if you put $2 trillion worth of money into the stock market when it was at its bottom in 2009. Like, that's what they could have done.
It's a basic investment strategy. Buy low, sell high.
Yes. And when the recession hits, it's as low as it can go. And you have the unique ability to create money in that period. Other people, they've lost all their money at that point. They can't invest. You can create new money. And when you're creating new money at the bottom of an economic cycle, it's stimulative. So it actually helps bring the economy back. One interesting example of a country who's done this recently is Japan. The Bank of Japan has been buying up what they call exchange-traded funds, basically stocks that cover the whole stock market. Mm-hmm. They've been buying that stuff like crazy. I don't remember the numbers off the top of my head, but just accumulating massive amounts of stocks and exchange-traded funds.
And we kind of did something similar to this in 2008-09 with TARP, the bailout, except you didn't put the assets into a, you know, a sovereign wealth fund.
Right. Yeah. I mean, bailouts, when they take the form of like equity injections, they're basically is the same idea. It's like, well, this sector is going really badly. We should buy up the companies sort of in order to get money into them. And then the intention is to sell them later. The idea here would be don't sell them later. And also it's not focused on sectors that are about to collapse, right? I mean, that's a kind of a separate question of do we need to bail out the banks versus should we snap up these cheap stocks when we can? It takes the same kind of form. We did the same thing with General Motors. When General Motors was going down in the recession, the U.S. government, I think, took like a 60-70% position in it. They owned 70% of General Motors for a few years. And General Motors came back, it got regained health, and they sold off the stock. But you can just hold on to the stock. You don't have to sell it off, you know. Yeah. So that's sort of the idea.
Okay. So one of the things I want to ask you about, you know, whether in a lot of other policy areas, I think folks on the left are sometimes critical of, you know, technocratic solutions to policy problems where, you have this Rube Goldberg mechanism of policy to address, you know, basic needs for people. So my question is, why set up a sovereign wealth fund where we have these, you know, methods to, you know, either tax people or countercyclical asset purchases or, you know, natural resource extraction to fund a fund, which then grows and then we distribute certain resources to people. Why not just raise tax rates on wealthy people and use, you know, the welfare state that we have now, whether it's, you know, food stamps or other benefits?
Yeah.
Why do we have to have this whole new system?
And you can do both, right? So this is not meant to be a replacement of the other approach. But I mean, my basic thinking on this is, look, if you want to be really serious about taking on, you know, the millionaires and the billionaires, well, what are the millionaires and the billionaires, what are they involved in? Like, what are they really doing? Like, what is that money? Like, when we say Bezos' wealth increased by $20 billion last month, like, what are we actually saying? What we're saying is his ownership of stock increased in value by $20 billion. What really affluent people do is they become stockholders, they become bondholders, and they own real estate. That's where all their money is. And so if you want to take them on and kind of knock them down, you've got to grab those assets. And it's unfortunate that those assets are very complicated in some ways to like explain to people, but that's just what it is. That is what capital ownership looks like. It is very complicated. But you can't allow its complication to scare you off, because the net result of that is you just say, well, let millionaires own everything because it's too complicated. We can't explain it to people.
Yeah. All right. So we've talked a lot about the social wealth fund, which you're working on now, but tell me some other things that you're working on at People's Policy Project. What are some other exciting ideas that you're looking at?
Yeah. So we have two, I would say, pretty exciting ideas in the hopper right now. One is a carbon tax. Obviously, that's not a new idea, but we've got a paper that we're about to publish on that presents analysis on the distributional effects of a carbon tax. Basically, it shows that if you use a carbon tax to raise money and then you kick that money back out as a payment to everyone in the country, then poor people end up much better off than they are right now. Affluent people end up somewhat worse off. So you can use a carbon tax to both reduce carbon emissions, which is important to avoid climate catastrophe, and also to redistribute income, which is important because we have really high income inequality.
Interesting.
The second thing is, and we've already published this, is social housing. We have these housing crises throughout the country, especially in metropolitan areas where rents are super high, people can't afford to live. And what we're proposing is to have municipal governments build their own housing and then rent that housing out in a kind of mixed income way. So, you have some lower income people who, you'll set a rent for them, and then some middle income people and some higher income people. So it's kind of a take on public housing, but instead of public housing that is meant only for the super poor, it's a form of public housing that everyone can be invested in, helps reduce residential segregation, helps increase buy-in and support of that kind of program. So it's a sort of a new approach to public housing.
Okay, got it. All right, well, I think we're at the end. This is where you get to plug yourself and your organization. You want to give a website or?
Yeah, please go to peoplespolicyproject.org. Like Dan said, we're completely donor-funded, people-funded, crowd-funded. People put in about $5 a month. And so the more people we have supporting it, the more stuff we can do. We don't take donations from anyone, not corporations, not foundations, nothing. It's all crowdfunded. So peoplespolicyproject.org, log on, click the support People's Policy Project, and you can donate on Patreon, you can donate on ActBlue.
All right, Matt, thanks so much for joining us. Thanks so much to all of you for joining us. That's it for this installment. We'll see you next time.